This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, episode 12, was recorded on July 24th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I'll be joined this week by petroleum geologist Art Berman, commercial broker Pat Hemsworth, and former market regulator Chris Cook. Our topics this week will include the EIA's massive 10.8 million barrel drawdown and the unexpected downside price reaction to that event. We'll talk about the situation in Iran. We'll talk about the Pemex hedge, the 2020 hedge for Mexican national oil company Pemex. It will talk about underreported Permian fracking and a host of other issues. But first, let's dive right into the EIA inventory and production data. Crude oil inventories drawing down 10.8 million barrels. Massive drawdown, and I want to give credit where it's due. Our panelist Anas Alhaji, right after last week's episode, tweeted his prediction of a drawdown between 9 and 12 million barrels, and sure enough, it came in right in the middle of that range. So hats off to Anas. We'll have him back with us on next week's panel. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.4 million barrels. Gasoline drawing down 0.2 million barrels. Distillates building 0.6 million barrels. The tape action. Of course, there had to be a little pop-up in reaction to such a massive drawdown, but it was only a little one. We barely even got a little bit higher. It didn't last very long at all, and boy, oh boy, by the end of the session, we were down dramatically, with the last 30 minutes seeing what felt almost like panic selling in the futures market going into the 2:30 pit close. We ended up closing below all three of the short-term moving averages, 5, 8, and 13-day, which suggests the beginning of downtrend conditions. And we briefly touched about 55 spot 30. And as we're recording the show well after the close today, I'm looking at about 55 spot 87 as of 4 p.m. on Wednesday. Again, that's below all of the short-term moving averages. U.S. production down massively, 700,000 barrels down to just 11.3 million barrels. That's fully 1 million barrels less than we had just a few weeks ago. The thing is, you've got to discount this as a hurricane-related data anomaly. So it's going to be very, very important to watch and make sure that that's all it was. But we can't read too much meaning into down production the week after a very significant hurricane caused the shut-in of at least 15 different operating platforms in the Gulf of Mexico. Imports, 7 million barrels per day. Exports, 3.3 million barrels per day. Now let's meet this week's expert panel. Pat Hemsworth is a commercial broker with Paragon Global Markets, and her decades of experience in both the paper and physical markets gives her tremendous insight into the dependencies which exist between those markets. Pat, Mexico is getting some attention in markets this week, not only because it began its 2020 oil hedge, but also because the AMLO administration released business plans for Pemex. Can you share some of the highlights with us?
Yes. You know, Pemex is the national oil company of Mexico. It now is under an administration which is, I guess you could say, populist, leftist kind of administration, in contrast to the previous administration, which actually introduced very bold liberalization plans for the energy industry in Mexico. But for many reasons, Peña Nieto was swept out of office, probably with the populism and the kind of protectionist mentality that's sweeping many different countries. AMLO, previous mayor of Mexico City, was elected, and he's put into place a plan to try to upgrade the energy industry in Mexico. And this is very important because Pemex, as a national oil company, is very integrated with the financial strength and the economy of Mexico as a whole. And the company is burdened by debt and is right now suffering from a lowered, gradually depleting production. It used to produce several years ago, it was up to 3.2 million barrels per day. It's now down to 1.7. And its refinery system, which is has a 1.46 million barrels per day capacity, is operating at less than 40%. There's widespread crime on the infrastructure, you know, people stealing fuel from the pipes. And overall, it's inefficient. It is inadequate for the Mexican population. They have to import 70% of their products, mostly from the United States. Last I checked, we were exporting 1.1 million barrels of products a day to Mexico. So part of AMLO's nationalist program is to try to become self-sufficient in energy. And he came up with a plan, very, very important for investors and for rating agencies looking at sovereign debt. So right now, Fitch has them one grade above junk. So this plan was very important, and actually it was disappointing. And it was disappointing because half of the money was planned. Okay, $7.5 billion was budgeted for 3 years. This is the period of time that AMLO will be in office still. And for that period of time, he wanted to build two refineries that many professionals are looking at almost as white elephant plans in the south of Mexico, 300,000 barrels apiece, with no infrastructure for probably half what the industry thinks they can be built for. He's looking to do it for $8 billion. So this plan that was just floated gave Pemex $7.5 billion, and half of it goes to this Dos Bocas refinery project. The balance is going to offshore oil production, but it really does not give the kind of incentives to foreign investors for infrastructure development and technical expertise. This is a kind of Pemex go it alone, we don't need anybody sort of approach. And so far, what we're waiting for is we've gotten some feedback from the investment community and from the rating agencies. And so far, you know, it looks like it might be pretty challenged. So that's where we are right now with Pemex.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Pat. Our next panelist is Chris Cook, a former market regulator with decades of experience in energy markets. Chris, my question to you is very simple. What the heck happened to political risk? We have the ultimate nightmare here, the threats to close the Straits of Hormuz. And furthermore, there was just reports of possibly the U.S. downing a second Iranian drone, and oil prices are down on the news. Where's the risk gone? What's going on here?
Yes, Eric, it really is a very, very interesting situation, when, especially when you compare it with the way the market was orbiting, you know, was 2011, 2012, when there were problems in Libya, you know. I take a sort of a big picture look here. I think that at the moment, things are more apparent than real. I think that China is the key player here, and I think they have one serious big red line, and they have had at least since 2007, and that is the Straits of Hormuz stay open. They are the only decent connection that Iran currently has. They, you know, Iran cannot actually antagonize China. So what China wants, as far as Iran are concerned, actually pretty much goes. Similarly, they are the only player who can scoff, actually, at what the US says. And I think that's precisely what happened in recent times. So, you know, both sides are really bigging up the, you know, they're really bigging up the threats. It's a bit like worldwide wrestling diplomacy at the moment, what we're seeing. It's a lot more apparent than real. What was happening, my understanding was that, in fact, the US was putting drones through Iranian airspace. And basically, you know, Iran got, you know, sign off from the Chinese to do something about it. And when push came to shove, the US consulted China about this. And China said, actually, no, this is a red line for us. They would not have the Straits of Hormuz closed, essentially. And they're in a position to do something about that economically. They can pull the plug in a way that, you know, the US really would not like. So I think the Straits of Hormuz stay open. I don't think the political risk is as it appears to be. I think both sides have certain rules. I think Iran have reached a point at which they can say to the Chinese, look, you're going to have to take so much more oil. Otherwise, we are in a position. This is what we're hearing now, these noises about, you know, the security of the Straits of Hormuz coming from Iran. You know, that's what Rouhani is saying. Also, I'm pretty certain that the reason President Trump actually knew that 91% of China's oil came through the Straits of Hormuz, because that's what he said at the time when it all went down, I think the reason was that the Chinese told him so. Okay, so I do think there is a sort of red line in play here that both sides are playing, you know, playing games, but behind it, Iran is going to be supplying oil. It's not a question of if, but how. We have, you know, it's a matter of, you know, ship transfers. There's some great reporting from tanker trackers on this. I give them full credit. You know, I read them assiduously. Well, that's one thing. And I think also we also heard that a lot of Iranian oil is going to China and then being stored. So I think actually push comes to shove, Iran will be exporting to China. There are Chinese trading entities who actually take this stuff. And you know, we just heard that the US is sanctioning one of them. I can't even pronounce the name of them. So, you know, all is not as it appears. And I think so, therefore, bottom line, the risk is not what people think it is.
Thanks for that perspective, Chris. We'll come back to the Iran situation with the entire panel a little bit later on. And our final panelist is Art Berman, a petroleum geologist who spends most of his time drilling oil wells, but he's also become a favored keynote speaker and consultant to investors. Art put together a slide deck for today's show, and you can download it from our homepage at macrovoices.com. Art, natural gas prices wiped out all the gains of the last month this week, falling $2.25 per million BTUs. Yet the term structure completely reverted to normal annual contango for the first time since early 2017. With year-over-year gas growth at 9 billion cubic feet per day, why aren't gas prices at $1.70 or less as they were in 2016? And why do forward curves suggest concerns about supply security?
Well, those are great questions, Eric, and I can provide you with some guidance, although obviously nobody's quite sure. But the gas markets are extremely clairvoyant when it comes to where future supply is. And frankly, I think that all of the things you just described are reflecting the fact that gas markets are uneasy about the level of LNG exports and pipeline exports to Mexico. So this has been the, you know, the rallying cry of the industry. We're overproducing, we're killing ourselves on prices, so please let us export gas. And the government was glad to let them do it. And the government, of course, not only under Trump, but also under Obama, have been the leading cheerleaders of the so-called shale gas revolution. Hillary Clinton had 50-some-odd people in the State Department, if you can believe it, promoting the export of U.S. technology on fracking. When Trump came to visit Texas a little while ago, I think it was in May, he made a special visit to look at the LNG export facilities. He hates oil. He loves gas. So this is sort of where we're at. But we've gotten to a point now where our exports have reached 5 BCF a day and are projected to get to almost twice that within just a very few months. And I think that markets are looking at this drain on supply that's going to exports. And they're also seeing that although, yes, 9 BCF a day is one heck of a growth rate, but it's fallen. It's fallen from nearly 11 BCF a day just in January. So, I mean, everybody knows, just like China's economy can't continue to grow, that natural gas supply can't continue to grow. And while we're still, you know, way up there in the stratosphere of growth, it's falling and it's falling markedly. So markets are concerned. And so what we're seeing then also, I think, is about this time every year, markets start doing the calculation. Gee, do you really think we're going to have enough gas for winter heating? And of course, inventory levels are hugely low. They're not quite as low as they were last year, but last year was an all-time record. So I think you bundle it all together and the markets are saying, we feel okay about this thing called supply, but not so much that we're not willing to put a little bit of money on it. So that's where I think we are.
Thanks for that, Art. We'll be back with our first major discussion topic after this. For our first major discussion topic this week, we've got to take on the EIA reporting a 10.8 million barrel drawdown. Now, normally that would be a just incredibly bullish price signal. You'd expect to see prices go to the moon. But actually, we saw oil prices move down on the day. What's going on here? Could it be that the after effects of Hurricane Barry are creating an anomaly in the data and the drawdown isn't really a drawdown of the significance it appears? Or is there something more to it? Pat Hemsworth, you're on the front lines for issues like this, sitting on the commercial trading desk at Paragon Global Markets. What are you seeing and what are you hearing and how do you explain oil down on a 10 million barrel draw?
Well, as far as the draw is concerned, perhaps some of this has been already discounted in the market because of the hurricane. And people know exactly what the offshore platforms were producing and how many were evacuated at different points during last week. But in general, what this EIA report recorded was that we're down 700,000 barrels a day on production. And that sort of lines up with the, that's within the report. And as far as imports, we got lower than we expected. Also, exports were significantly higher. Last week, we had interruption in exports because of the weather in the Gulf of Mexico. So we were up there. And there was also an adjustment, which may or may not be accurate. I don't know. It was up 524,000 barrels. But I'm not quite sure. We were all a little bit stunned by the fact that the market really couldn't even maintain itself above unchanged. Different things were being floated. And one idea was the Mexican hedge, which may or may not be being executed right now. We just got the formula. We just heard that Mexico had calculated what their exposure was and that they started hedging. So I think it's a combination of things, but the production level is accurately reflected in that big draw.
Thanks for that, Pat. We'll come back to the Pemex hedge and how that might be playing into what's going on in the market a little bit later on. Let's go to Art Berman. Sir, you are the king of comparative inventory. What does the comparative inventory model tell us about what's going on in today's market?
Yes, Eric. Well, the comparative inventory tells me that, sure, we had a giant crude oil draw, and yet the other components, the refined products that go into comparative inventory, gasoline, distillate, unfinished oil, et cetera, every single one of those went up. Their comparative inventory levels went up, which is to say that either the draws were lower than the norm or the additions were greater than the norm. So to me, this is I won't say it's a clear-cut situation, but it doesn't surprise me what happened at all today. I listened to our friend and colleague, Anas Alhaji. He says, boy, you guys better expect a big draw. I pay attention. He was right. But then people like Chris Cook and I have been saying for some time, yeah, but you got to pay attention to the refined products. And by the way, I know Anas looks at those just as in as much detail. But what I see going on right now is that the demand side of the oil markets is affecting the refined products. And so we in the United States can draw down our oil inventories as much as we like, produce more and more product, which apparently demand is not quite sufficient to use. And voila, the result of the inventory draw is, I mean, it's still notable. The overall comparative inventory went down 4 million barrels. But that's not as much as it went up last week. And if you look at the net over, let's just say, the last month, it's going nowhere. And final comment is that this week's data plots smack on the yield curve, which is to say that price is where it's supposed to be. And the fact that the market didn't move price any higher or any lower is not a shock to me.
And Chris Cook, you've been kind of predicting for a few weeks now that we might see more weakness in the market. Are there any surprise today, or what do you make of this action?
Yeah, that's really interesting, Eric. I mean, I've always taken a holistic look at the market, because on the one side you've got the the demand side is, in fact, you and I don't use crude oil, we use products, and that's where the demand actually falls. You know, it's the end use of products, and then the question is, well, how does that fit in with the crude oil supply? So what Art just said is really quite interesting. I think that we are going through a major change in market structure. I've been saying this for some time. I think this is a matter of Chinese strategy. I said this in Moscow last April, it was, that China is the buyer of last resort when it comes to crude oil. They can buy from people that nobody else can really buy from, thanks to sanctions. They've been building out refining capacity. They can gouge whoever they want to gouge. And what that means is they can actually dump gasoline and products on anybody. You know, they can just dump them and produce a glut potentially in the Far East. I'm not sure what the current situation is, but that, I think, is where China is going. That is their strategy, to actually undercut to produce, if you like, the buy side strikes back, is what I see. The Chinese are strategists, and that is what I think their strategy has been for some considerable time. And we'll have to see how that plays out in the next, in the next months to come. So I think that the products glut, I think if there is one, and I think there probably is and there will be, we're going to actually be seeing that in the next 3-6 months. And I'm reminded how this worked out in other markets. We saw something like this many years ago in sugar. Tate & Lyle basically ruled the market from the buy side. London Metal Exchange was set up the way it is because it was a buy side market. And we take for granted that the producers are going to be kings of the market. I don't think they're going to be forever. So that's just me taking a big picture strategic view here. I think we need to watch the products very carefully.
Thanks, Chris. Two of our regular panelists, Anas Alhaji and Tracy Shukart, are not with us this week, but I do want to just credit Anas, right after our last show last week, tweeted his prediction of a draw this week between 9 and 12 million barrels. We're right in the middle of that range. I have not spoken to Tracy, but I don't need to. I can read her brainwaves. What she would say if she were here is, buy a big build, sell a big draw. Contrarian trade, that you can't put too much faith in the meaning of these numbers, especially after a hurricane week. Pat Hemsworth, I'm very curious as to your reaction to what Chris just told us about finished products. You're obviously sitting on a commercial desk, and I know you deal yourself in the physical market, actually selling tanker cargoes of finished products to South America and so forth. And I know you have a lot of insight into this. What's your perspective?
Well, I'm very focused on the Atlantic Basin, but of course, what's happening in Asia affects us as well. And so we've been watching what's been going on in Asia in terms of product buildups. And as Chris mentioned, there's been an increase in refinery capacity in China. And so for a while, there was a building up of floating storage in Singapore, and there was quite a few products. But at this time, that's beginning to work down, and margins are getting better. And actually, China is increasing runs. So refinery margins there are improving, and the product levels are probably at around the 5-year average. They are improving as well. They are being drawn down as well. Probably Europe has the crummiest refining margins right now, and the U.S. has very good refining margins, with PADD 2 being the best. no transportation, cheap crude. PADD 3, the complex refiner profiles are very, very profitable. So at this moment, you know, yes, we are concerned about ongoing reduction of manufacturing activity and shipping and transportation. And we're watching all those economic indicators because they are down from last year. But it's really not a crisis. It's not a terrible thing. You know, the margins are not bad here, certainly.
And Chris Cook, you're in Europe, whereas Pat is on a desk in the United States. What do you hear on your side?
Yeah, I mean, I am very much focused on the Far East because, as I mentioned, I think there is, you know, the China are positioning themselves in terms of supplier of products, last resort, if you like. They're able to undercut everybody else. And Philip Villega actually was quite interesting in this regard. He was just commenting along these lines that he saw that weakness in, and this ties in with the view that the problem is lack of demand for products, that weakness in products leads to weakness in crude, you know? I suppose it's refining 101, isn't it? And I do think that's what's happening in the market right now. It's weakening. I think $60 oil is expensive oil. You know, we think, oh, 110, 120, that $60 is actually quite cheap, but it's not. It's expensive enough, in my view, to actually deter demand. I'm pretty certain that's what's going on here, big picture.
Art Berman, what's your take?
I just wanted to add that I agree with Pat that if I gave the impression that we're in a refined product glut, then let me correct that. I don't see that, and her comments I think really, you know, expand on that. But what I do see and reflected in this week's inventory report is that refined product demand is not as strong as it has been. It's probably weakening. Maybe we're in some kind of a transition period. So where we go from here is an unknown, of course. But going back to my initial comment on this inventory report, nothing about it surprised me. And I give credit where it's due. I already did to Anas. But yes, I expected a big crude draw. And no, I didn't expect a huge comparative inventory change. And just to follow up on another of Pat's comments, that getting back to this unaccounted for oil, and I'm almost certain Chris will want to add something here, the adjustment this week was more than 3 million barrels to the positive. So if we just went on the input-output side, field production, net imports, and refinery intakes, the crude draw would be calculated at almost 14 million barrels. So the fact that we had 3 million barrels added as unaccounted oil is the reason that we only came out at 10 and change. So, and just to repeat what I've said on previous podcasts, I don't think that this unaccounted for oil is a fudge factor or, you know, some sort of glitch. I mean, I think this oil is very real and it's unaccounted for lots and lots of reasons. But my guess is that it's already been counted as production months ago and it's been sitting on the lease. EIA doesn't follow lease inventories anymore. And when that gets put out onto the market, it is therefore unaccounted for.
Thanks, Art. Let's move on now to our next major topic today, which is the situation with Iran. Now, it would seem that the news has been pretty darn strong. A second Iranian drone shot down by the United States, I saw reports of. There's been a lot of rhetoric out of Iran suggesting that they're ready for war. They're going to get tough. They're not going to back down. All of the messaging is very consistent with escalation toward major conflict. Yet it doesn't seem that this is affecting the price. And it's very baffling to understand. I want to start for this segment with Chris Cook, because Chris, in the Western media, we really hear what I think is a fairly one-sided story. Everything about Iran is completely, you know, they're evil and they're unconditionally evil and they're bad guys. And there's just nothing more to it than that. There's always two sides to every story. And I know you've actually visited Iran yourself. I wonder if you can give us not just the current situation, but the bigger picture backstory. What is the perspective of the people in Iran and of the government, and how do they see this situation?
Yeah, thanks. I have been to Iran many times. I've been there a dozen times since 2004, invariably to do with markets. In my role as a senior research fellow at University College London, I've basically gone there wearing an academic hat, most recently looking at energy fintech, which is an interesting subject in itself for maybe a different discussion. But they are extremely rational. And they're not what people think in terms of the, you know, the revolution, the Islamic revolution was 40 years ago, you know, and in the at the time when they were the most radical, you know, under Khomeini, well, guess what? They were actually exporting oil to Israel, thanks to Mark Rich. You know, oil sort of transcends all ideological differences, Eric. You know, it's interesting stuff. And since that time, we've seen very different motivations emerging over the years. And we're now in a very interesting sort of market position. They feel very hard done by the US. They are taking a very, very measured approach when it comes to what's happening at the moment. We saw, for instance, the British carry out this adventure of, you know, of arresting the tanker in Gibraltar. And frankly, I think that's one of the biggest mistakes. That it really was a crazy piece of work. But it's noted that all the Iranians have actually done is, guess what, bagged, you know, a British flag tanker in exchange. And that's all they're going to do. There's no way they're going to do more than that. You know, it's tit for tat. It's what the Iranians always do. And yet we're hearing rhetoric about how the Iranians are escalating. Well, I'm sorry, it was the Brits who escalated. And they did it because they were asked to by the White House. It's that simple. And so I think we are seeing now, for instance, the Iraqis have just popped across to Tehran to see if we can't actually come up with some sort of tanker swap. You know, everybody's looking to dial down the tension here. The Iranians want to. You know, everybody really wants to. But behind all of this, it really is not a US issue. The real issue is what's going on in Syria, what's going on with the, you know, in the Lebanon, what's going on in Palestine. The real issue has always been between Israel and Iran. And I do think there is a dialogue there to be had, but it cannot be a direct dialogue at the moment. You know, that is how this is going to actually be resolved in due course. There has to be some, you know, a sort of some very, very, very careful diplomacy. But I think actually behind all of this, both sides actually do want to do this. Minister Zangani, the oil minister, very, 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 very canny guy. You know, he's been around since the year dot, 20-odd years. He talks about energy diplomacy and energy cooperation. And I am convinced that that approach is possible. You know, you might have religious difficulties. You might have left and right wing. You know, like communist Russia was exporting gas to Europe throughout the Cold War. You know, anything's possible when it comes to energy. So I think there is an attempt going on now to dial things down. Quite clearly there is. It's not a question of if, it's a question of who. You know, the Japanese came along, President Abe came to Iran, and guess what? A Japanese tanker gets attacked. Well, wasn't that a crazy thing for Iran to do, you know? Now we hear in Pakistan, President Khan was in Tehran in April. Iraq are next door. Everybody is sort of trying to come up with a way forward. But, you know, behind all of it, we have to actually get to grips with the real point. This is a big picture sort of net assessment of what's going on here.
Pat Hemsworth, what's your take on Iran and what are you hearing about how it's affecting markets?
To me, it doesn't appear that Iran is looking to dial things down. You know, I think Abe going to Iran and then having his having Japanese tankers being attacked by the Revolutionary Guard isn't really dialing things down. I mean, what it looks to me like, and I think Chris has much more on the ground experience, and I'm just speaking from my perception and just my conversations and understanding of the market, but it appears that, you know, Iran is registering its unhappiness with its current situation by keeping things hot, but trying to keep them stable. But my concern is, I mean, I think right now the market is ignoring all of this. if I may just go back one second to the issue of Straits of Hormuz, I don't think this is separate. I don't think that the Straits of Hormuz would ever really, they've never really been closed. And it's in nobody's interest really for that to happen. So kind of think that's not really a factor. But in terms of the market is not reacting to any of this stuff. And, you know, you kind of wonder why. Maybe this is like a strange sort of calm. And people seem to think Trump doesn't want a war, Iran doesn't want a war, the UK doesn't want a war, the Japanese don't want a war, nobody really wants a war. But yet we have military vessels in the you know, in the Gulf, we have drones being disabled and destroyed. We have these different events happening, the Gibraltar event, which, in fact, I think Chris is reading on that is what I hear. You know, and then the stopping and holding the crew of the UK ship. So, I mean, all of these things are just making things a little bit more nervous. And, you know, and it just increases the possibility or the chance of some kind of accident. And these accidents happen. The U.S. was involved in a terrible, quote unquote, accident in 1988, you know, when we accidentally shot down, misread airplane and thought it was a military airplane and it was a passenger flight. You know, these kinds of things can happen. And so I think, you know, the more of these smaller events that happen to raise the tension, the more dangerous it is. And in a way, I just think the market is undervaluing the potential for trouble there.
I really agree with, I agree with both. I don't want to sound boring or neutral, but a couple of comments. The thing that worries me the most is that I don't think Trump is running the show. He's focused on tweeting insults at, you know, various Hollywood stars, and of course he's watching the Mueller reports. I mean, you know, this is a guy who he's interested in what he's interested in, and he's got all of these B team players running the government, including the Defense Department, and you know, now we hear that, you know, his national security advisor Coates is on the way out, and he's thinking about appointing this, you know, Devin Nunes as his successor. And, you know, we've got all these acting kind of people. So who knows who's really calling the shots in Iran? And of course, we've got Pompeo and Bolton, who have very clear ideas about what they would like to do. All that said, the one thing Trump always knows is what his base wants, what they don't want, and what his campaign promises were. And he promised to decrease our international involvement. Now, that doesn't say that an accident, as Pat very nicely put it, couldn't happen, and he could explain that to his base. But he's also, you know, he's kind of a paper tiger. He snorts a lot and threatens to blow your house down. But when it actually comes to making hard decisions, he usually backs off. I come back, though, to some of Chris's comments from earlier in the discussion. Understanding China's role in this thing is absolutely paramount. They are the ones that get the most imports through the Straits. They are the ones that are taking most of the Iranian oil. They are the ones that, at least apparently, are dumping refined product on the market. So it's just, I mean, nothing's ever simple. But this is clearly a complex issue. But overall, I think the market, perhaps Pat is right, perhaps they're being a little bit too calm, but the market's obsessed with demand. The market thinks that demand has fallen off a cliff. And so why should they worry, the market thinks, about a few million barrels here or there? And I'll leave it at that.
Let's move on now to our next major subject, which is the 2020 Mexican Pemex hedge. A lot of people in the oil market are very aware that this time of year, the hedging programs which are engaged in by Mexico's national oil company, Pemex, have sometimes profound impacts on the market. But not all market participants have a deep understanding of how this works and why it works. Now, personally, I've become a master of this game, so I'm going to confidently pretend that I know what I'm talking about and defer to Pat Hemsworth to explain the situation. Pat, take it away.
Thank you. Well, okay, Pemex hedges its oil production, and they usually come up with a, you know, risk assessment. They assess their own need to hedge by the late spring and then begin in June or even now. But now this year they're doing it a little bit late. But essentially, they do a risk assessment. They figure out what their exposure is. They're importing products. They're exporting crude. They're importing some crude. And so they assess their portfolio, and then they begin to talk to investment banks. There's several large ones. I believe there's 50 different entities that are dealing with Pemex. Overall, they have 1.7 million barrels a day of production. They're importing probably somewhere like 1.4 million barrels a day of products. And so they're looking at these mixes and then going to probably Goldman Sachs is one of their biggest bankers. But what they do then is the bankers will give them prices and they will be buying puts. And that makes, say, Goldman Sachs, I'll just use them as an example, short puts. And that makes them essentially have uncovered long positions, which they then hedge through options and futures all the way along the curve. So they start now executing and all the way through, probably do the bulk of it in the, you know, from July through the fall, and the months that they concentrate on are December 19 through June of 2020. So that's essentially what they do, and they do it every year. Last year, they locked in their sales price at $55, and this is all WTI, and they spent a little over $1 billion in premium for the puts. So and I think they're doing some fences too. But anyway, that's essentially it. And it started already.
Let's do a little thought experiment. If they're buying all these puts, which means their bankers are short the puts and need to lay that risk off in the futures market, it would seem to me that maybe an explanation for today's action in prices is the bankers were saying, pretty widely expected that we're going to get a great big drawdown in inventory. That's going to spike prices up. Let's use that price spike and the strength that it's certain to bring to sell a whole bunch of those hedges that we need to sell. And I'm almost wondering if what happened is that was the plan, but the market didn't cooperate and they still needed to sell what they needed. Because something I thought was very interesting, we sold off after inventory down to just about the 34-day continuation contract moving average. And, you know, we were bouncing above the 8-day moving average back up to almost $57. And then it was right into the last half hour before the pit close that we moved down almost back down to $55 again. So it almost felt like somebody had a whole bunch of futures they had to sell today. And as we got to the last half hour, they said, crap, we're going to have to just dump them here. Does that make sense? And could it be that action in the market today was related to that hedge? Because I'm still having a real struggle to explain how the heck we got such a big down day in reaction to such a big draw.
Okay, so yes, I mean, that's a possibility. There's no way that we can know that, though. You know, I mean, let's say, you know, in the end analysis, the exposure is real and it's big and it needs to be hedged, but it doesn't have to be done all at once. And they're looking for higher prices. So it's a possible explanation. I just think that the market is so huge, you know, really 1.7 million is 1,700 contracts. And, you know, when you think about that, of course, it's more contracts if you're breaking it down into options. But the market is so huge that it can absorb that. And I'm not really so sure we could explain today's actions by that. But certainly, most likely, this is being actively managed right now. and it's a factor in the market. We just don't know exactly how.
Let's move on to a subject I wanted to ask Art Berman about, which is Permian Basin. Obviously, the headquarters of the shale revolution is in the Permian Basin. In order for investors to be able to make the right decisions, we've got to rely on data that comes out of the Permian about how many wells are being drilled and fracked and so forth. And Anas Al-Haji's had quite a bit to say about the quality of data deteriorating. How accurate is the information about fracking that goes on in the Permian Basin? Art, you actually drill oil wells for a living, so you have firsthand exposure to this.
Well, the answer is a resounding, we don't know. Basically, all of the information we have, or that I have certainly, on fracking comes from EIA or comes from Frac Focus, which is sort of a cooperative effort. But the newsmaker this morning or last night was that a very well-placed fellow, formerly with British Gas and Schlumberger, has said, gee, you know, all of this, we've got high-tech ways of measuring or detecting all of these frac crews and et cetera. And the story that we've been told by EIA is completely wrong. And in fact, what's happened is that there are an awful lot of wells that are reported as drilled and uncompleted, which have in fact been fracked, and it's just that it wasn't reported that way yet. And the result is that we're attributing a lot of production to a smaller number of wells than may actually be the producing wells. Net effect is the average per well performance, not as good as we thought. The other, of course, is that the amount of money that's been spent is quite a bit higher. And I think he even cited something north of $4 billion more on these fracks that supposedly never occurred. So that's the headline, and all of that's really, really interesting, I suppose, except that I'm not really sure what to do with it. It seems to be, though, part of a thread in the news where people are essentially looking for reasons not to believe the Permian Basin story, which I would advise, you know, fools rush in. Beware of that story. The Permian Basin is pretty good stuff, and I've looked at it in great detail. And unlike the Eagle Ford and unlike the Bakken, there are still lots and lots and lots of infill locations left. I also think the threat of, you know, of anti-Permian or whatever has, you know, spread to this whole notion of, oh, these wells are all changing into gas wells before our eyes. You know, that's crap. That's just not really, that's not happening. And so, you know, Winston Churchill's famous comment about, you know, rumors of my death are exaggerated or whatever he said, I think that applies to the Permian. However, when we look at the rig counts, and we lag the rig counts to either production or oil price, but mostly production, what I see is that there's every reason to believe that growth in the Permian is at or near its peak. And you can do this exercise lots of simpler ways than that. But to me, rig count is really important because that tells where capital is being spent, where it's being directed into different plays. And so that leads me then to say, look, if our expectation is that tight oil in general and Permian tight oil in particular is basically all the world needs and we've got an oversupply and let's not worry about it, I think that's a very wrong approach. At the same time, I think the Permian has more left in it, quite a bit more left in it than a lot of opinion makers are saying. The other thing I'd like to add at this point, though, is that there's no doubt that the capital, that a lot of capital has exited from the tight oil plays. Now, this capital is conventional capital. In other words, bonds, share offerings, you know, mezzanine financing, et cetera, et cetera. And Chris and I have had lots of conversations about other ways for these companies to get money through prepay agreements and et cetera, which I think is worthy of discussion. But back to my interest in natural gas, all the funding, all the capital is now going into LNG. And one little company, Venture Capital Holdings or something like that. I mean, these guys who I've never heard of, which doesn't mean anything, have raised $10 billion just in the last few months for an LNG export terminal in South Louisiana. I mean, $10 billion. And I've been watching this every week. And just a few, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, they had less than $3 billion, which was still a big number. And as of this week, it's 10. So all the money is pouring into LNG. This is the next wave of shale hysteria, whatever. That's what I think is going on. And the irony, the great irony is for those who have questions and doubts about the cash flow and financial health of the shale, the tight oil business. Oh my gosh. I mean, look at the economics on LNG export and what landed prices in Europe and Asia are right now. I mean, they're like in the $4 range, and just the cost the Henry Hub plus shipping is almost at that level. So, I for many years I've kind of run for the Maylocks whenever I hear people talk about how much money all these guys are making. But LNG export from the United States and Canada for that matter continues to make absolutely no sense to me. And yet that's where the money is. So that's what I have to say about shale today.
Listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town and that we intend to become the definitive weekly information source for energy traders, investors, and others interested in energy markets. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes or at macrovoices.com, and you'll also gain access to our Thursday night macroeconomics podcast. We're also looking for sponsors so that we can keep all of our Macro Voices content free to the listener. To save time here on the podcast, I've prepared a detailed video explaining the opportunity for sponsoring Energy Week and other Macro Voices content. You can find the video at www.macrovoices.com/sponsor info. If your company's interested in sponsoring Macro Voices, please email me at info@macrovoices.com. Before we close, I want to ask our panelists what they're going to be looking for in the week ahead in energy markets. Chris Cook, why don't we start with you? What are you going to be watching for?
Well, I'm just looking for the next round in the Strait of Hormuz game, actually. And in particular, what the Brits are going to be doing with this with these tankers. I do think we'll see common sense break out after this. We've got a new prime minister as of today, Boris Johnson, and he's completely changed his crew. And, I have a feeling that common sense might well break out. But, who can tell? Our new government is, shall we say, Boris Johnson and President Trump have, I think, quite a lot in common. They're both showmen, I think. So we're going to look in some, it's going to be interesting to see which way our new government jumps.
Pat Hemsworth, what will you be watching for in the week ahead?
Well, I'll be watching all the relationships and all of the differentials, as I usually do with products and crude, doing my business here. We're going into expiration for the product, so that's always a little bit of a drum roll kind of drama thing. But we're also having a couple of other things happening next week. Trump's people will be going to China for face-to-face trade talks. So, although I don't expect any major breakthroughs, so there's always a possibility of some kind of headline coming out of that. And also we will find out about the interest rates and what's going to happen with the FOMC. So that's on my radar for next week.
Art Berman, how about you? What are you watching for next week?
Eric, I'm really interested in crude exports, U.S. crude exports, which we didn't talk about this week. As you know, this has really been the driver for bringing down U.S. inventories and a number of other important aspects of U.S. storage. And for the last couple of weeks, exports have been going nowhere. This week, we went down a little bit, basically flat, same last week and the week before. And I think this is directly related to the Brent premium to WTI, which has been diving. And so We've gotten some bounce here recently on volumes, inventory volumes, because of an extra terrestrial event, this Hurricane Barry or tropical storm depression, whatever it was. But I think that the eye is off the ball of exports that have been driving. And I expect exports to continue to be weak until that Brent premium goes up and creates a better arbitrage. So that's the main thing I'm watching over and above my normal obsessions.
Macro Voices Energy Week is released every Wednesday evening. Next week's panel includes Art Berman, Anna Salhaji, and Tracy Shuchart. And we do have a quick housekeeping note this week. All of the new content on the Macro Voices podcast network has been fantastically popular with listeners, so popular, in fact, that it has crippled our server. So we're upgrading to a new server, and that's going to require scheduled maintenance. So the Macro Voices website will be offline Sunday afternoon, probably around 5 or 6 p.m., and will stay offline for the rest of the evening. That is scheduled maintenance. There's nothing we can do about it, but we will be back on Monday with a brand new server and much more bandwidth and the ability to deliver even more content. But before we let this week's panel go, I'd like to ask each of you to please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do. Let's go back to Chris Cook.
You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is CJENSCOOK. That's the best place to find me.
And Pat Hemsworth.
I can be found on Twitter, and my handle is @PHemsworth. And also, listeners can contact me if they like at PHemsworth@ParagonGlobalMarkets.com. And if they would like to get my daily market recap, I would be happy to send it to them. They just tell me what their interest in energy is.
Don't miss that one, folks. Pat writes an excellent daily commentary that you don't want to miss. And finally, Art Berman of ArtBerman.com.
Well, you said at ArtBerman.com. I'm on Twitter as Pat and Chris are at AEBerman12. And if you want to get in immediate contact with me, try businessmanager, one word, at artberman.com. I do a lot of public speaking, expert witness testimony, consulting, you name it. So you can find me at any of those places.
Fantastic, Art. I want to thank our entire panel. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. We'll see you next week, everybody.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.